Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Tom, if you had to make a dish associated with a TV show, which would it be?
I would love to eat the pizza from Breaking Bad. He kind of throws in a huff, he throws a giant pizza pie on the roof of his house, like a pepperoni. And that, in terms of scenes from a TV show that stand out in my head, that one reigns supreme.
I'm going to go with The Wire, lake trout. No lake, no trout. A fried fish sandwich, Baltimore style. You put a little hot sauce on that. The lake trout. That is a Baltimore classic. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haverstroh.
Tom, we're down to 7 chefs, episode 10, season 6. Great rewatch. Lot going on. We as the aforementioned TV show TV dinner challenge was sort of interesting, and then we have a fun elimination as the chefs take over Tom Colicchio's restaurant, which is a kind of a big deal. But first,
hello Natalie Portman too.
Oh yes. I am bearing the lead. Natalie Portman is a crucial player in this episode. Let's start with TV dinner, or if you have general impressions about the state of the show right now, I am all ears.
Yeah, so when you look at this episode, Mike Isabella, of course, big story there in the aftermath of this TV show. But for me, this episode was all about Jen because she's been in a rut. And watching her totally struggle in this episode while seeing Robin also struggle, but almost in like a carefree way. But Jen just seems so in her head and she's shaking as she's plating her dish. And, you know, Natalie Portman is so wonderful. Lots of dick jokes happening in this episode. So in terms of like my favorite episodes of this season, I would say episode 10 here with Natalie Portman. It's up there.
Mm. I it's interesting how often Jen is a protagonist. One of the interesting things that I think happens, and it happens on a lot of episodes, or rather a lot of seasons, although I think less than it used to, is the desire of the producers to really zero in on a couple of main characters. And whether that's a function of their personality, which it generally is, their potential as a chef, their arc, you know, so like chefs that start without competence and build competence become over time, I think, a character they'll zero in on just because it has a natural arc. And it's Jen's season in many ways, along with the Voltaggios, just because of the novelty of brothers. But this episode sort of solidified that. I mean, she is, you know, there's best actors and then there's the supporting actors, you know, which are eligible in which category. She's a best actor slash actress.
For sure. For sure. And, you know, I felt for her on this episode in many ways. We'll start with the TV dinner. The challenge was sponsored by TV Guide, I guess. Is that right?
Oh, was it? It wasn't Swanson's. I forget.
I don't know.
I think it was TV Guide. I didn't know TV Guide was still around. Indispensable publication before your time, by the way.
Oh no, I definitely remember every time we went to Caldor or CVS, we would always grab a TV Guide on the way out.
You know, black for network, little gray for UHF stations. It was a very well designed magazine. Like the content of it for its age was just, it was kind of pleasant to look at in addition to getting your TV because you had no guides. You just had to like crack open the TV Guide to figure out what the hell's on, which is just hilarious that I am of age enough to remember. Like, get the TV Guide. Where the hell is the TV Guide? Oh, great. We don't know what's on. Now we have to have a flip. And that's how you did it. And
it was like an important publication. Like whoever got on the cover of the TV Guide, that was like being on the cover of, you know, Time Magazine.
Like every house had TV Guide. I'm not every house, but I rarely knew a house that did not have TV Guide. It is, again, it is the guide. I mean, it was how you, it's so indispensable.
So did you eat TV dinners?
You know, we were kosher much of my childhood, but early on we weren't. And a little Salisbury steak, absolutely. I mean, I was kind of a one horse pony. I mean, one trick pony there because I didn't really veer off. You know, the chicken dinner with the breading sticking to that tinfoil, which actually oddly created this sort of extra gunk of oil. So definitely had the fried chicken with a little corn. That was a popular one. But I don't remember any above that. And then we went kosher and in like the new kitchen or whatever. And that ceased to be a thing.
Yeah. My mom, she always said only 30 minutes of TV a day. And so I would always watch Wild and Crazy Kids or any Nickelodeon show. And then like, of course, my dad would like throw on the Red Sox game. But we would never eat on the couch with a TV dinner. Right. So I know the concept of a TV dinner. And I distinctly remember a few times eating a TV dinner where you kind of pull the plastic cover off of it and then the steam pops out. And so this sort of concept for the quick fire, it definitely harkened back to some of the moments in my childhood. But I wouldn't say I was a veteran of TV dinners.
Oh, we had no TV limit in my house. And there was much syndication going on between 4 and 6 when I didn't have like a activity or something. Like, and Atlanta was a great market to grow up in because you got the Jeffersons at 4 and 5, little Good Times at 4:30, which then was replaced on the CBS affiliate with Alice, a big popular one in my house. And then as like early 80s going to mid 80s, it becomes a Family Ties rerun house, along with Silver Spoons, by the way. Big Ricky Schroeder. That was a 4:30. I think on the NBC affiliate, maybe. But you know, there was no limit in our house. Like, Stacy and I watched just a shit ton of television. Like, we're both very. I think we've both seen every Jeffersons episode ever produced. Probably right there with Alice. But yeah, there was no limit. We soaked that shit up.
Which of these – so they gave out Gilligan's Island, MASH, Sopranos, Flintstones, Sesame Street, Seinfeld, Cheers. Am I missing one? Like, is there one? Is there one that you watched more so than any of those other shows that you would have been excited to get?
I mean, you can go Italian with Sopranos, and it's a really easy interpretation. I mean, Cheers is good for a quick fire because, like, again, beer food, right? Like, or I'm sorry, bar food. You know, Flintstones is hard to. It's like you got to kind of do the brontosaurus rib. Like, you know, I don't know any other. And then Seinfeld diner food with Tom's, or you can go a little New York deli, make a knish. I don't know if you can make a knish in 30. Yeah, yeah, like I you know, Gilligan's, you can do anything fishy. So, but I think the key is, yeah, I mean, to me, Sopranos gives you a pretty wide berth, whereas Flintstone gives you a pretty narrow berth.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear that Kevin didn't really watch The Sopranos because he was just like, just, you know, doing the whole family spread thing. I felt bad for Jen here because when you get Flintstones, you want to get the big old hunk of meat on the end of a bone, right? A big old ribeye or a tomahawk. Like,
and or she turkey goes leg or something.
Yeah.
One of those state fair turkey legs.
Yeah. And she goes into the pantry and they don't stock anything with a big old bone on it. So I felt bad for her on that because if you're Top Chef, you want to stock, you know, you don't want to give them a challenge and then not have any of the ingredients on purpose unless it's part of the conceit of the challenge. So right off the bat, Jen is just working from, you know, behind on the scoreboard.
Well, also, I mean, like roulade is this year's risotto. Right? Like, that's sort of, you don't want anything to do with that. Who, you know, who was it that got, Robin almost got sent home for her roulade, or did she get, that was the Ash tenderloin episode. And Robin almost like, skated, you know, by the hair of her chinny chin chin with her right. roulade. So like roulade is just a kind of a loser. You don't want to do roulade.
Kiss of death. Kiss don't of do death. It.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. And so, you know, I don't know who this judge is. Paul Bartolotti. Do you know anything about this chef? I guess
never heard of him. Never heard of him.
Get him out of here. I liked him. I thought he was a pretty good host. He was fun. And, you know, Brian goes with the Korean meatloaf. And what I found fascinating about this one, you know, a playoff of MASH during the Korean War. What I found fascinating about this, Kevin, if you'd known nothing about Brian Voltaggio after this and the whole quickfire curse, I would have thought he won. Like this dish, I thought he was going to finally win the quickfire. And I was so excited for him. But then I got this moment of like, yeah, well, Tom, we know he never wins the damn quickfire. So why are you getting your hopes up?
Yeah, I mean, they like that tart tatin. The meatloaf was a winner. By the way, I was kind of, I mean, how old is Voltaggio / Brian or comma Brian? Because MASH, that was another rerun special. That was a total syndication hit.
My parents love MASH.
Yeah, my dad loved MASH. Everybody loved MASH. My house Monday night was sacrosanct. You could not bug my father. You couldn't bug my father during MASH on Monday nights. And then you couldn't bug my father Hill Street Blues on Tuesday night. And that was just his thing. He asked for 90 minutes a week of peace. And that was it. Like, you couldn't come into the bedroom where you like to watch TV. At 10 o'clock on Tuesdays, and I think 9 was MASH on Mondays.
So Brian knowing about MASH is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's, I mean, when was Brian? How old is Brian Voltaggio? How old is Brian Voltaggio?
I would say he's 45.
One of those guys, you know? 44. Okay, so he's old enough to, like, wow. have caught MASH in syndication.
Okay.
But looking good for 44, by the way. I mean, based on not this season, obviously, 17. I mean, there he's like 32.
Yeah, so he's he comes in second. He was in the top. Kev wins with his family spread. They really liked his dish. I don't really have much of an opinion on the other ones. I mean, Mike Isabella did sausage and peppers with Seinfeld. He's never watched Seinfeld before. I'm not a Seinfeld fanatic like some of our friends and colleagues, Kevin, but I would at least know a couple things to pull from that, you know, that show to be inspired from. But Mike does not. He doesn't finish in the bottom. Jen and Robin finish in the bottom. And Michael Voltaggio brings in the chicken parm, which I know he's going for bar food or pub food, Kevin, but chicken parm doesn't really feel like bar food to me. Like a fish and chips or a burger or a French onion soup, chicken
wings. What about
wings,
those mozzarella sticks dipped in tomato sauce, which is kind of your two-thirds of the way to parm?
Yeah. No, I'm with that. But a chicken parm, I feel like that's a deli. I don't feel like that's a bar.
That's more like an Italian. Yeah, like an Italian sub. You know, I think if you're going Seinfeld, my favorite food-oriented Seinfeld, and like you, I'm not encyclopedic in my knowledge of Seinfeld. It was on while I was in college, so I just like didn't have a TV. But I like the one where Costanza, like he sees the uneaten eclair in the trash can, right? Purely uneaten, not even mingling with the other trash, and just feels like it's completely acceptable to reach in there and get the eclair.
I mean, that would have been a great dish. Is something inspired by that moment on the right. show?
Can you do an eclair in 30 minutes? Or an hour. I think it's an hour. Like that's right. The question. Or because I think the eclair, although then you're up there, and I'm going to guess that Padma is not encyclopedic in her Seinfeld knowledge. Because that's the only problem is, for Seinfeldians, it will be brilliant. But if you're trying to describe the George Costanza's eclair episode, like, I think you're probably, if you're explaining, you're losing, as they say.
Yeah. If you have to kind of explain the punchline, you already lost the audience, right? But I do think that sometimes on Top Chef, when there's like a personal anecdote or a very vivid, very specific memory that you draw inspiration from, I think the judges appreciate that. And on this one,
that's not very personal. That's like, that would be like, you know, I hadn't seen my mom in 14 years and she really loves eclairs. And there it was. Like, I mean, that would have to be the term of that. I don't think they're going to go just because you like an erotic episode of Seinfeld, which is truly one of my favorites because that is so something I would do, Tom. Like to watch a perfectly good eclair just get thrown away. I mean, I got to tell you, I've certainly had the urge when I like go to Sugarfish or sushi and like people leave untouched pieces. Like, and I'm walking by and they're getting up and leaving. It's like, I mean, practically speaking, there's no utility to throwing that shit out. And it's like, not like it's like a half eaten steak.
Did you ever work as a server?
Yeah, I did in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Did you ever eat anything off a plate that was, you cleared from the dining room and then go back into the kitchen? I certainly did that a whole bunch.
Okay. Like I'm maybe a rogue French fry. Maybe like, I don't recall. Did you?
Yes. Oh, yeah. There was this place called Bravo in Fairfield, Connecticut. And I would there was this amazing dish of like calamari with some hoisin sauce or something like that. And
calamari and hoisin sauce.
Oh, yeah. It's like fried calamari, right? Yeah, okay. And they would sprinkle this hoisin sauce on top. And then, you know, it would go out. And 99% out of all of the dishes that went out, they would just get gobbled up. There was not even a speck of fried, crust from the calamari. But on those rare occasions where you find the golden ticket, where there's a few left over of the calamari, and I'm a much bigger fan of the tentacle calamari rather than the discs of the calamari. I don't know how you feel about that. The rings of the calamari.
Oh, your ring but versus tentacles.
Yeah, I'm very much team tentacle. And so when those were left, a little few left over on the dish, I would just pop them in my mouth like they were just Tic Tacs, you know? So I'm a big fan of that move. I don't know how we got off on that, but this is what this show is all about. So elimination challenge, Kevin, what'd you think about it?
Well, I mean, I think, look, vegetarianism always, I mean, either it's interesting or it's not. Like in one respect, you don't get to see them, you know, work their strengths. And so that was sort of like, I miss the protein in a challenge, right? On the other hand, you know, Natalie Portman's charming. It is interesting to see there's a certain adaptation a challenge like that requires. And I think it's important. It's an important skill for a Top Chef contestant. So you want to push them every third or fourth episode to really adapt. And I think this was one of those. So, I mean, generally speaking, I'm okay.
Yeah. I hear you. I feel like when they announced that they're just going to go take over Tom's restaurant, Kraft Steak in Vegas, it's like, there's gotta be something more to this. Cause this doesn't seem like at this late in the game that there was enough there. And then of course, Natalie Portman is brought in as the surprise.
Right. Well, by the way, like in the words of Tom Colicchio, what's the challenge?
Yes. If you haven't listened, that is a reference to our sit down with Tom Colicchio, full episode you can go listen to on our Twitter feed, or sorry, our YouTube at Count the Dings, or just scroll back from the Pack Your Knives feed. We did a whole sit down with Colicchio, and that was one of the things we pitched, and he said, what's the challenge? I mean, what's the challenge? So on this one, the challenge is, plot twist, going to a steakhouse, not allowed to cook meat. And once again, Jen on this episode gets screwed. She wants to do eggplant, and she can't do the eggplant that she wants because Eli also wanted to do eggplant. But after that, but even before that, she wanted to do morels, mushroom morels, and two others were doing morels. And if I'm Jen and Kevin's going to do morels and Robin's doing morels, guess what? I don't care if they've done it. I'm going to do it better than them. Maybe it's a matter of scarcity that they're going to take it and I just don't have any morels left, or I'm going to get the runt of the litter of the morels. But if I'm Jen, I'm just going to do the morels because I know that's my first pick, right?
Yeah. So a big surprise for me, at least, in this elimination challenge is nobody does pasta or risotto. Now, I know risotto, obviously, I don't know if it had its reputation yet in season 6, but pasta, like, it's such an easy way to do vegetarian food that is savory, tasty. You know, a constant theme of the judges was, oh, this is a real dish. You can make a meal out of it. And I'm just shocked that you had 7 chefs and not one chooses pasta. I'm not criticizing. I mean, the ones that hit. But I just think that for those who were struggling, it would have been. And again, not everybody makes pasta. It is something. But I was shocked.
You know, it didn't occur to me, Kevin. Like, I did not think about doing pasta in that place, but it makes all the sense in the world. The showrunners might have said you can't do pasta because none of them did it.
Right, and they didn't go to the Whole Foods, right? This was a what's in the pantry. So there might – now, but you can with flour. I mean, the people who make pasta, we're talking about flour, we're talking about egg, you know. But, I mean, it's just I was very surprised. And, you know, especially Jen in this – she's the sauce master. I mean, you do a ravioli of, like, you know, butternut squash or even that eggplant if you really – like there are things you – maybe not eggplant, but there are a lot of things you can do, obviously, with veggie pastas. I mean, and a great sauce. And you're done.
How about Eli, who's never one to, you know, mince words or anything like that? He just goes, yeah, you know, in the confidence of, you know, like-minded people, I would say that vegetarians are lower – people.
that was a very 26-year-old chef to say. But, you know, I appreciate his candor, and that's all you asked for. So
yeah. Is there a dish, Kevin, a vegetarian dish that instantly pops into your mind when if someone says, ooh, we're having a veggie meal tonight? Is there something that you're like, I hope it's this? I guess it's pasta for you.
No, I mean, I have to be careful in the pasta, just, you know, carbs. But I'll tell you one of the things I like, and we were just talking about it, is like a really good eggplant parmesan. Guilty pleasure veggie food. Like, I just love eggplant. What's interesting here is there is a great vegan Japanese restaurant down in Little Tokyo called Shojin. And if all vegan food was this tasty, I would be vegan. It is so good, but you know that, you know, I love a good eggplant parmesan. I'll take a meat and three without the meat. You know, I love those southern vegetables. But yeah, that's basically it.
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got 2 cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like,
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
Yeah, let's just start with Mike Isabella here at Leeks. I don't know if I could pick Leeks out of a lineup. Like if I was eating a bunch of dishes, veggies, I don't think I could pick Leeks out. That's probably just me being a novice eater maybe. But that choice by Mike Isabella was very, very confusing.
Well, also because Leeks, like, they're kind of filler. I mean, look, I'm sure some chef would say you haven't had my Leeks, but so they look like almost when you see them at the farmer's market, kind of like green onions, but a much bigger white kind of, it doesn't, you know, like, okay. So that's kind of what they look like. And they're just kind of filler. Like that is not a meal. I'm just trying to think like roasted Leeks. And again, maybe I'm wrong, but it's just kind of in the root vegetable, like turnips. Yeah. Turnips are fine. I have a turnip recipe that I make with a little citrus and stuff, but like it's turnips. And that's how
it's
I feel
not a
about
made
Leeks.
Event.
Yeah, it's just not. I was shocked at the beginning because it seems like trouble. Like the ceiling on a leek dish is so low.
Yeah, and you know, he thought he was gonna cut it into discs, almost like a scallop, and he ended up just kind of boiling the shit out of it, and it looked awful. It looked like even the overhead shot, Kevin, of the overhead shot of the pot that he cooked it in. I was just like, who wants to eat that? And then he presented it on the plate and it was not happening. And right away when he decided he was going to go with Leeks, I was like, this is not going to end well. He has all the confidence in the world, but he does the Leeks. And I didn't really think that was a smart move. And of course, you know, Robin decides she's going to do a billion things. I honestly, in my notes, I just have it written down. Lots of things happening. Don't even know what this dish is.
She just doesn't have a perspective. You know, you can go up and down the list of chefs and they all have, a perspective, right? You know, Michael Voltaggio wants to reinvent. He wants to deconstruct and reconstruct. He is fascinated with what you can do with substances. You know, Brian Voltaggio, likes to play with texture, probably a more mild version of Michael, but that restraint and structure certainly, you know, gives him something. You know, Jen, we talked about just kind of just, you know, fresh, simple ingredients, kind of an East Coast Suzanne going, great with sauces, classical. And you can go down and like Robin, it's sort of like, I don't know, what is the point of view? Like, what is the arthurial voice there? Like, I don't know.
Just talking. That's it. Like, I don't know. I don't know what hers is. And she says, I don't know whether she is vegetarian or that she eats a lot of vegetables. Like, that's her diet. But this just seemed like she had an idea of what ingredients she wanted to use. And then, ooh, there's some fresh garbanzos. Ooh, there's this and there's that. I'm going to use it all. And then she just throws it all in and like fresh garbanzos. That sounds really good. Like, again, haven't had that. Sounds really good. And yet there's like a bunch of different things on the plate. So
do a duo of beets with, you know, with the tremula. I mean, that's a decent dish if you execute the beets are substantial. Do them two ways. I know you're not supposed to do duos, but I think when the vegetable, it's a different story and you want to get something. Like, I just you could have done that. You could have done that. You could have done just a good beet dish with a really good, you know, tremula and maybe, you know, some herbal, you know, something, a component that sort of works with the North African motif. Right. I mean, I don't know. Right. Just like, what the hell? Yeah. I mean, fresh garbanzo beans. Just because they're there and you're interested and you're curious doesn't mean you use them.
Mike Voltaggio, once again, does a dish that's so Michael Voltaggio. Very confident in his abilities, the concept, the banana polenta that almost put, you know, half the judges in a shock. Then you had the asparagus done a couple ways. Conceptually, execution, I mean, he's a juggernaut. This dish definitely, you know, when we have the debates about Giannis versus LeBron and who's going to be the MVP of the NBA, and we just say, you know, LeBron has, in normal years, it's an MVP caliber season. This dish by Michael Voltaggio was LeBron, where it was like, you know what? MVP caliber dish, winning dish for Michael Voltaggio. And I feel him is that, you know, when he presented the dish, I kind of felt like if this tastes good, as good as it looks, it has a cool story with the bananas and the polenta. I thought he would run away with this. And then, you know, Kevin comes in with a dish that me personally, I would most like to eat.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, I love mushrooms. Mushrooms are some of my favorite things in the world. Am I right that Mike, you know, Voltaggio threw a little shade at Kevin there, right?
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I was surprised. I thought there would be at least mutual respect. Yeah, presentationally, Kevin's dish wasn't that. It was much more of a down-home dish. But, you know, I think there's an appreciation, especially, you know, with vegetarian. It's, you know, I mean, there is, you do, I think substance is something. And sustenance really is something you want because they can be overly light, like you want them. And look, it works. And he won, by the way. And you know, that he got a twofer. He won. He swept. He swept the episode.
Yeah, it's very rare that we have it this season where you sweep the episode. I'm not sure we've seen that. But it's hard to do, especially with this kind of talent on the board. And I feel bad for Michael Voltaggio on some level that, you know, maybe his dish from a talent perspective, from a conceptual perspective, was actually more impressive than Kevin's was. But you know what? Kevin's just tasted fucking good. And at the end of the day, you got to hit flavor, and it seemed like everyone on the table just loved eating that dish, and that's what it's all about. So Voltaggio, I get it, but when you're having a vegetarian meal, I'm not looking at like, ooh, I want asparagus. Like, that's not the move. I'm going to want a mushroom, whether it's a portobello steak or something like that. I love eating mushrooms, and so I thought it was really smart by Kevin to just go get the morels, get the hen of the woods, and just go with a very heavy, substantial mushroom dish that felt like, you know, you're eating a real protein. And yeah.
You know what dish I would have ordered on a menu?
Which one?
Eli's. That looks delicious. Eggplant confit. I mean, really, when eggplant gets soft, it is so pleasant. I mean, it might, for those who don't like mushy food, but if it still has a little form, like, you know what dish I love? You go to a lot of Chinese restaurants. It's just like that sticky eggplant with a slightly spicy garlic sauce, and it's just gummy. That viscosity is just great, and it's got flavor, and it's just so, like, I love the texture of that kind of eggplant. And it looked like it's kind of what he, you know, similar to what he was able to accomplish. And, you know, the cream lentils and radish salad, like, that's just a good, I'm very partial to eggplant. And so, like, that's a really good thing. Speaking of which, going back to Isabella, man, you're like, you got the, like, why not do a mezza? Why not do a little, your own take on baba ganoush, your own take on lebneh? You know, some of those, like, you know, what's the one with the red peppers? What's it called? What's it called in the Armenian place? But anyway, I'm surprised that would have been such in the style of what he does in, you know, what he did in Washington. I was sure that's what he was going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of those moments where I thought Isabella was talking a lot, talking a big game, and just everything that he actually did walking was just bad. And that this I've been hard on Isabella with his Greek interpretations of a Greek salad, et cetera. But, you know, just from concept to execution did not work. And Eli, you're right. Looked like a very delicious dish. I'm actually going to go with Jen's preparation of the eggplant. I love a torched eggplant.
Yeah.
Like a burnt eggplant, some char on there. That's the kind of eggplant. I don't like a medium rare eggplant. I like a torched eggplant. What say you?
I certainly want it to have that slight mushiness and preserve. Again, yeah. Like my that eggplant with garlic sauce is my favorite. I love baba ganoush though, but I also love a char. I really do. But I don't, I'll be honest with you, those discs that people just throw on the grill at a barbecue, no appeal to me. Zero.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Zero. So judges table. One last thing, you know, because Kevin won, and I do want to say this, and going back to that, I could have made that dish in 20 minutes. I'm of two minds about Michael Voltaggio, and this is general. It's not just about his barb on Kevin. Number one, my first reaction is, well, why didn't you? Why didn't you?
Yep.
You can make it in 20 minutes. Why didn't you? Okay. Number two, I also feel him. And this is not a knock on Kevin. You know, when Jay Leno got the Tonight Show and, you know, after his first couple of years, I think in a large segment of the comedy community, some of whom even kind of like Jay from Boston, you know, their whole point was, like, what are you doing with it? Right. Like the idea is if you inherit the definitive late night variety show, late night talk show, that you're supposed to play with the form. Right. Like you're supposed to play with the form. Why do you even get into this business if you're just going to do a milquetoast version, a milquetoast interpretation of this form? And that was sort of their beef with Leno. I think everyone thought he was a pretty good guy. You know, it wasn't that he's terrible. It was just that you're not doing anything with it. Like you were given this gift. It is your responsibility as a comic to take forth the night show on NBC and bring it into the, you know, and you're supposed to evolve it like that ape thing with the five apes, you know, like, and I think what Voltaggio is saying is, what are you doing with it? And that is generally when he gets kind of sassy, that's generally what he's saying, and I appreciate it. Like, why would you get into the cooking business if you're not going to just completely go crazy? If you're not going to say, this is, like, and I do appreciate it. But part of me was also, though, again, I could have made this in 20 minutes. Then you should have. You would have won.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, you got to give the people what they want. And they want a really tasty dish. And I think Michael Voltaggio's was probably very impressive. Technically,
yeah.
But in terms of just making you feel like you had a very satisfying meal, I think Kevin wins. And you know what? He probably admits that. Like when, if you're looking at the two dishes, he's probably saying that one's the Michelin 3-star dish. And mine's probably just a really good dish. I'm getting Kevin wrong here, but you know, I appreciated the the, you know, Brian Voltage, who didn't even, we didn't even talk about
him. It's always a funny of the seven contestants left, you automatically know who finished fourth. You know who finished first, fourth, seventh. You generally know two and three. Like, I think it's understood that Michael was second, Eli was third. It was kind of understood Jen was fifth and Robin was sixth. So it is interesting. You get the standings, which, you know, I think you and I would be much, like, we'd be much more satisfied if they kind of published to the box score.
Yeah, we could do a point system that way. Yeah. But I think you're right. And Voltaggio was in the middle. It was Goldilocks. It was fine. Not too, you know, appealing, but also not too boring or anything like that. So he was, you know, kind of, this was not his best episode. But yeah, Kevin wins. Voltaggio's pissed off, says he could have done it in 20 minutes. Then we get to the bottom. Robin, Jen, and Mike Isabella. Robin kind of kept digging herself into a hole. And if anyone does herself any favors at the judges table, Robin does not. She just keeps talking and yapping. And, you know, I thought Jen almost would get into a trap here by saying, you know, I feel like I prove I belong. Just give me another day. I thought Tom Colicchio was going to jump all over that.
Yeah, it's beneath her.
She'd be like, oh, you just think you belong?
Right. Clearly. He's unimpressed with ambivalence about one's talent.
Yeah. And I adored Jen just saying, you know what? I get nervous in front of the judges. Yeah, I was super nervous. I'm nervous right now. My hands are shaking. And, you know, I felt so bad for serving those dishes. And I don't think it's really about the celebrity getting like spooked by getting starstruck by Natalie Portman. I think this is probably just nerves. Is you work so hard. I think she cares so much about her food that she gets nervous up there. I totally get it. And I was kind of shocked that Isabella was the one who went home. I thought Robin was going to get sent home. Yeah. And knowing the beef between the two, I don't think I remembered, you know, watching this season initially. I don't think I remember that Isabella went home before Robin, but here we are.
Have we ever had a season before or since with such a weak chef in the final six?
Whew, good question. So I'm going to stand up for Robin here. Isabella says in his outro, basically on his way out, his exit interview, he's saying, you know, I guess I could be in the bottom eight times like her, but you know what? You know, and she just goes off, right? Robin has been in the bottom three three times. Isabella had been in the bottom three twice.
Does that include quickfires? No.
It doesn't include getting voted out. Essentially, he was in the bottom and survived twice. She was in the bottom and survived three times. This isn't like, you know, lapping the field here. Like, Robin, probably not the most qualified chef up there, right? But it ain't like she was actually in the top like a couple episodes ago. And she's also won a quick fire. So I get it. She's probably the weakest link. But in terms of running up the score, she's so far behind everyone else. The stats don't point to the same conclusion. So Isabella, I think the interpersonal, his beef with Robin actually spoke louder in that moment than what the stats showed. Like, she actually hasn't been as much of an underdog as you would think just going by the standings.
Yeah, he hadn't been setting it on fire since the beginning. Yeah, I had forgotten that this was not the season where he really showed himself. I mean, you're right. He hadn't performed enough to really earn that critique. But it's still interesting. I mean, she is, I just don't recall anybody who didn't at least have either creativity or technicality or sort of warmth to their food. You know, every once in a while you get, who's the guy who did like the gumbos from Southwestern Louisiana a couple of years ago? God, who am I? I have no memory whatsoever. But, you know, I think you either have to have like technicality, creativity, or sheer comfort. Like, your food is just so tasty because, like, and I don't think she has any of the three. And that's sort of strange because it's late in the day. It is late in the day. And she's also been expert at finishing second to last. Again, the classic, you don't have to run out the bear. You just have to outrun the other guy. She is outrunning the other guy consistently.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, I want to ask you about this. Did you know that leeks don't have any protein?
I mean, it's such filler. It doesn't surprise me.
Is it like celery? It's
a slightly upgraded version of, I mean, at least celery has some practical application. It's a nice crunchy, you know, thing that you can dip stuff, you know, using to dip stuff. But leeks have no practical application other than their filler. Other than if you want to bring a little water, like when I braise in the fall or winter, I will use leeks sometimes. Because they just kind of provide that, you know, it's almost going to be included in your mirepoix. I mean, even though that's technically not, I mean, celery is that, but like, I'll use it then just for shits and giggles, for changing stuff up. But they are absolutely useless. They really are.
So it got me thinking, Kevin, what vegetable has the highest content of protein? Ooh. And so I looked this up, and the top protein veggies, number one, lima beans.
Oh, that makes sense.
Lima beans have the highest proportion of protein. I guess 11.6% is protein. Number two,
if you want me to eat lima beans, sprouts. I'll eat lima beans. From which movie in the 90s? You want me to eat lima beans? I'll eat lima beans.
My memory is shot just like yours.
Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jerry Maguire. When he finally kind of realizes he's got to listen to Tom Cruise. You tell me to eat lima beans, I'll eat lima beans.
Got to eat my veggies. Yeah. Lima beans, soybean sprouts.
Is that really a vegetable?
I guess.
Never heard.
Green peas?
That makes sense. Favas?
Spinach?
What about favas?
Interesting. Yeah, probably.
Are they on the list?
They are not on the list, but they might be like a cousin of one of these categories.
I'm surprised about spinach, Tom. That's a surprise. Kind of leafy.
Spinach, yep. Sweet corn, asparagus, artichokes, Brussels sprouts, mushrooms, broccoli. Thought mushrooms would be higher on that list, but those are the top ones. And at the bottom you have, you know, probably leeks, but I did not know that about lima beans, but that is your Haberstadt big number for this week's episode of Pack Your Knives. You learn that lima beans has lots of protein in it. Back to the show. I wanted to – one last thing before we get into Isabella. Natalie Portman had the line of the show. When she's reviewing or talking about Mike Voltaggio's dish, she goes, "Who is his dealer? And does he want more clients?" That was awesome. That was great.
Drug humor.
I thought Natalie was, it was a little weed humor. Yeah. That was good.
I'm surprised they haven't had Harold and Kumar on.
Yeah.
That would be a fun challenge. That would
be good. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've had stoner food adjacent challenges, but they've never really embraced it. I wonder with the legality changing across the country, if that will change.
Okay, so Kevin, let's talk about Mike Isabella. The Where Are They Now? Mike Isabella edition. And we've gotten a couple people on Twitter throughout the season being like, "Hey, what did you guys think about Mike Isabella and are you going to address it?" Well, here it is. The story is that Mike Isabella, after he left the show in 2018, there was a Washington Post big story about a former manager had alleged sexual harassment, extreme sexual harassment from Mike Isabella and a culture at work at his empire, a $30 million empire of restaurants. I believe he opened 11 restaurants in like just a couple of years, sprawling in and around DC area. A lot of those restaurants were apparently, in the reporting from Washington Post, were understaffed. There were a lot of business issues with Isabella's empire. And then on top of that, he was swept up in the Me Too movement that I think, you know, Mario Batali, other chefs of public fame had been, you know, engulfed in this. And Mike Isabella was one of them. Now, in 2018, the story comes out and then he has to closed down several of his restaurants and he's on his way back. But I think the thing I want to ask you about, Kevin, is, you know, after reading Anthony Bourdain's book about, you know, his rise through kitchens in New York City, I believe it was the 90s. Was it the late 80s and early 90s or whatever it is? There was just a lot of misogyny, of homophobia, of just the vocabulary in the kitchen was such that you wouldn't be caught hearing within a mile of church, right? So, you know, this is one of those industries that I feel like eventually this was going to catch up to them.
Yeah, I mean, and you and I work in the sports space, and one of the things I think we've realized is that there are certain industries and workplaces that regard themselves as exceptional, right? And this is what I mean. So the teams we cover in practice, that's a workplace, right? That's a workplace no different. Well, I'm going to say no different. That's a workplace the way if you're an accountant, like your cubicle, the way if you're a lawyer, your office, whatever it is, right? And there are things that you would never say in a law firm, a sales firm, whatever workplace you can imagine, a call center, that liberties are taken in these exceptional industries or industries that regard themselves as exceptional, right? Like players on a basketball court at 1:30 in the afternoon during practice will call each other. I mean, just on things that completely are outside the boundaries of professional life. And I think what you learn about the restaurant business is up until very recently, I mean, like in the last year or two, people in the restaurant business thought of themselves as part of one of those exceptional industries whereby we know this would not be permissible at a traditional workplace, but we are not a traditional workplace. Just like you hear about, you know, professional sports. This is not a traditional workplace. And by not traditional workplace, that's true in some respects. It is a very unique workplace, but that exceptionalism is internalized to the point where people feel like they can do things they shouldn't do, right? Like they can behave in ways, you know, because it's the kitchen. And in the kitchen, people yell and say, right? Like, no, but also just beyond the circle of trust, like you yell, motherfucker, you just get in somebody's face because there's 25 tickets and right? Like, so there's this environment that compels people to believe I do not have to play by the rules in terms of decorum, in terms of what's appropriate, in terms of respect for whether it's women, whether it's sexual minority, whatever it is. And I think that's caught up. And Isabella, to me, clearly, you know, by certain conduct, certainly got caught up in that. He was somebody who regarded the workplace in a restaurant as exceptional and that I wouldn't do this. I wouldn't behave this way in a professional firm. But I will because it's the kitchen, because it's like our business, Tom. Like what a player can get away with calling another player on the practice court. And that this is their practice court. And I think it start, and again, you talked about Kitchen Confidential. You talked about, you know, all kinds of reports. And people, look, we know people who work in the restaurant business. It is, you know, exceptional. However, what we're doing is we're narrowing the definition of exceptionalism. And no longer can you, like, misogyny is no longer an exception because you work in an exceptional environment.
Right.
And that's clear. And it's happening in these exceptional businesses.
Right. And you look at Bourdain's book, that was like the 90s, right? That's two decades ago. And this is 2018. And some of the allegations that that the former manager of one of his restaurants were the accusations, like it's a different time. Right. And it seemed like this has been going on for at least, well, look, put it this way. The comments that he made during this episode or this season of Top Chef definitely was raising eyebrows when I was watching it, being like, wow, that was something I did not think would fly in 2020 if Top Chef was airing again. And maybe we're just coming off a Top Chef All-Star season where you just didn't get a lot of that kind of color. It was very congenial. Like everyone was just playing by the rules and it was good because they all had great respect for each other. Now in this season, Mike Isabella definitely had some comments that were that may have not seemed over the line in 2009 when it aired, but nowadays it definitely comes off very differently. And so Mike Isabella had 11 restaurants in the DC area and has just about cratered all of that through the business side, which I think we've talked about on the show too, whether it's this season or last season, is just what if you're a chef and you find some success? Do you just keep expanding and spread yourself so thin? And maybe part of the stress of opening up all these restaurants, you just kind of you lose it a little bit. And I think he lost control of his business in what seemed to be a culture in his restaurants, and he's paying for it. And so when we look back on this season and Mike Isabella, he comes back in later seasons on Top Chef. But it does, I mean, he was quite a character on the show and a heel in some ways, an antagonist. But I did notice that Jen Carroll, when Mike Isabella was voted off, I mean, she gave him a big old hug, and to the point where Gail was, you know, taken aback a little bit about how sad they were to see Mike Isabella leave. And you could see Gail like clutching her chest, like, wow. They really, really cared about Mike Isabella. And so, you know, I think there, you know, when you look at Kevin Gillespie or Robin or whoever it is that had their moments with Mike Isabella throughout the show, he was a character. And where are they now since? I don't really know where Mike Isabella is now. He's on Twitter. He's on Instagram. I believe he's opening or consulting with a restaurant in Sarasota, Florida, obviously not in the DC area where he made his bones in the industry. But yeah, so Mike Isabella goes home. Robin is still on the show. And obviously that ticks off Mike Isabella on his way out. But Kevin, I just don't think she's long for this world. Top Chef, the bear is at some point going to eat her up, to use the parlance of Kevin Arnovitz, right?
For Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.